Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I was thinking of very old times when the Romans first came here, 1900 years ago, the other day. Imagine the feelings of the commander of a fine, what do you call them, trireme in the Mediterranean, ordered suddenly to the north. Or think of a decent young citizen in a toga, perhaps too much dice, you know, coming out here in the train of some prefect, land in a swamp, march through the woods, and in some inland post, feel the savagery, the utter savagery, had closed around him. All that mysterious life of the wilderness that stirs in the forest, in the jungles, in the hearts of wild men. Imagine the growing regrets, the longing to escape, the powerless disgust, the surrender, the hate. So, Tom Holland, that's how I feel when I come to London. That quotation from Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, in which Marlowe, the narrator, imagines the feelings of a Roman, a young Roman, posted to Britannia. What a god-awful posting that is. And he ends up in London, of all places.
Well, I think Dominic, it's actually imagining a Roman coming up the Thames estuary before London has even been founded.
Yeah.
Today we're going on a tour of Roman London, of Londinium. But I think that part of the fascination of Roman London for anyone who has, you know, who's apocalyptically minded, is the sense that there was a time when this huge city didn't exist, and yep. It's entirely a creation of the Romans. And then, of course, after the Romans leave, it collapses and crumbles again. And Conrad is writing that at a time when, you know, London is the great imperial capital of the world's largest empire, larger
Rome.
Than Rome. It is the new Rome. And it's prefiguring the story of Marlowe going up the Congo.
Yeah.
You know, the heart of darkness. And I think that we're standing now on London Bridge, the south side of London Bridge.
So set the scene for us, Tom. Yeah. Tell us what we can see. We've got St. Paul's over on the horizon, the great dome, the symbol of the Blitz and all that stuff.
Yeah, so we're on London Bridge. We've got the Thames flowing, the vastness of the Thames. We've got the embankment has been built up. We've got the great kind of monuments to Mammon, the great towers of the city, and then we've got the Tower of London on the right side and Tower Bridge. But thinking about Roman London takes us back to a time when none of this existed, when there were no wharves, there were no build-up. The Thames was a kind of great bog. And the reason that we're standing here now and the reason that London exists is because it's crucially, this is the lowest bridging point on the Thames.
Where we are now?
Yeah. So when the Romans land here, AD 43, they need to cross the Thames. And probably this was a fording point where we're standing now.
It's a hell of a long ford, Tom.
It is a long ford. But they had Batavians who came from...
Batavia.
From the Netherlands, from the Low Countries, who were very adept.
The producer's very amused by that.
Giggling away. But they shouldn't be, because the Batavians were serious guys who they could cross rivers in full armour with their horses.
That is impressive. I hope
so. They were able to do that and get
Tony.
Across. But it very, very quickly, the Romans built a bridge here. And on the far side, roads were then built going to northwards, westwards,
So you were telling
eastwards.
Me there's nobody, it hasn't occurred to the Celts to... I mean, if it's a fording point, there must be some... Is there a settlement?
As far as we know, there was... there was an oppidum, so a kind of a hill fort, a kind of proto-town at Woolwich.
Right.
But no other settlement, really. I mean, maybe the odd farm. But essentially, that description in that Conrad gives you of the trireme coming up the Thames estuary and looking out and seeing nothing but savagery and barbarism. I mean, it wasn't. But, you know, we're talking mud flats. We're talking forests.
Yeah.
There's nothing here. And this is what makes London unusual in the Roman context, is that by and large, when the Romans move into a place, they set their provincial capital up in a place that is already a major center.
Right.
So that's
a trading
absolutely.
You know, market town.
So the major settlement in Britain when the Romans invade is Camulodunum, Colchester. So that Colchester duly becomes the first capital. But London is kind of great. So, you know, the famous description of London is that it's the great wen, a kind of great pustule or boil or spot that grows on the country.
Yep.
And that works perfectly as well in the Roman period, because there's no plan to build a founder city here. It just grows organically.
Why?
Because this is the lowest bridging point, as we said, and the bridge is built here, but it's also a port. So you can sail up here. So that is what makes London and has always made London the obvious capital once you have a unitary state in southern Britain, because this is kind of made by geography to be the capital. And that essentially, so it kind of grows organically in a way that by and large in Roman Britain, most cities don't. Most cities here are artificial.
We're about halfway over the bridge now, heading towards the city. Tell us a bit more about the people who lived here when the Romans arrived. So they're Celtic.
Yeah.
And the sort of stereotype is basically they're painted blue, you know, daubing each other in mud.
Drinking milk.
Yeah.
Absolutely vile customs.
Just behaving disgracefully.
Yes. Shocking. No, they're a bit more civilized than that. They are, you know, they're on the periphery of a great empire. And so, like most peoples on the periphery of a great empire, they're influenced by it. So they're starting to invest in wine. They're starting to copy things like coinage. They may well actually be tribal entities here who have already essentially submitted to the Romans even before the formal invasion.
Why do the Romans bother? I know that's a huge question, and we don't want to have it dominate the whole episode, but in a couple of lines, this is not a very, you know, as the Conrad description suggests, it's not a terribly attractive part of Europe. They're so rich already and powerful. Why do they even bother?
Well, Britain is actually very, I mean, it's agriculturally rich. It's full of minerals.
Tin.
It is also, it's there. And empires expand.
Okay.
And Claudius, the emperor who launches the invasion, you know, he famously, people who've watched Like Claudius will know, he stutters, he limps, his head rolls. he wants to cut a dash.
Yeah, he needs it for political reasons,
needs it for political reasons. And so actually, the very first representation of Britannia, so the figure who appears on our coins, it appears on a frieze in a temple in what's now Turkey. And it shows Claudius as a kind of iron-bodied rapist. He's raping her. So Britannia is the woman. Oh, right. She's had her clothes torn off her. Claudius is holding her. And that's essentially why Claudius launches it. He needs a coup.
He wants people to do mosaics and friezes like that about him, basically.
He does. Well, he wants to cut a dash. He wants to pose as an imperator, a general, an emperor. I mean, an emperor has that kind of that root in the military sense of it.
So, Tom, we're now on the just reaching the other side of the Thames, the north side. So at what point would you say do the Romans identify this as a future settlement? So within, you know, a few years of landing, or is it?
Yeah, as I said, I think it grows up organically. So it becomes a military base. They build a fort here. It controls, you know, the access to the continent. Yeah, so there's a document that's been found that dates from incredibly early on. So probably the bridge is built, a wooden bridge is here by 47.
Okay.
So
that's, within like 3 or 4 years of
Four years after the invasion. And then 10 years after that, and we can date it very precisely to the 8th of January, AD 57, you have an IOU. So somebody promising to pay money back. And what you realize is, so we're now crossing into the city, and we're surrounded by, you know, these great gleaming towers, monuments to money making. London, right from the beginning, has been about making money.
Yeah.
So traders are coming in here.
The ethos of the city has never changed.
The ethos of the city has never changed. You know, the Romans can appreciate a strategically crucial transport and military node when they see it. And that's why by the end of, certainly by the end of the first century, it's pretty clear that it's replaced Colchester as the capital of the province, because it is the obvious capital. But of course, before that, Dominic, there is the first of one of the many catastrophes that have overwhelmed the city of London, which hits it in either AD 60 or 61, which is, of course, Boudicca's revolt. We will head now up towards Bank Tube Station, serving the Bank of England.
Yep.
And there is a stretch of road there called Poultry. So in the Middle Ages, that's where chickens were sold. And number one Poultry was redeveloped in the 80s and 90s. And during the process of redevelopment, something extraordinary was found. So let's wait till we get there, and then
exciting.
We can discuss it.
That is very exciting. So, Tom, to unwitting eyes, it would seem that we've just stopped outside a branch of NatWest. explain to me the thrilling story behind this spot.
Okay, so we're now looking at number one Poultry, which was designed by James Stirling. The whole process by which it came to be built here was very controversial, because it was on the site of Maffin and Webb, which is a very handsome Victorian building. But from the point of view of Roman archaeology, it was great, because they dug down, and in the foundations, they found 48 skulls, all of young men, so clearly been decapitated and dumped there, and charred buildings. And these buildings have dated to around AD 60. So this is the evidence for what you get in Tacitus, the report of Boudicca's revolt, that she incinerates London.
So this
And London has kind of been burnt three times. This was the first. Then, of course, you have the Great Fire, 1666, and then you have the Blitz. And the reason that this was preserved is because of... You'll see we're standing on a street called Walbrook.
Yes.
And the Walbrook is a river that is running directly beneath us.
So it's a lost river, right?
Lost river. So the place we're by Bank, the Bank of England, and the Bank of England stands over the Walbrook. It's actually in a river valley. So we're between Ludgate Hill and Cornhill. And
you'd never know it, would it?
You'd never know it. But this river flows, rises about 2.5 miles north of the Thames, flows due south. And the Roman city basically gathered around it because they could use the river as an open sewer. And because of that, loads of organic material was preserved.
When you say organic material?
Sandals, letters.
Okay, that's better than I was expecting.
Well, yes, probably a bit more as well. And loads of this material has actually been preserved about 2 minutes walk from here. So if we head down southwards...
Okay.
So we'll head to what is probably one of the most, I think it is, the most romantic and exciting finds ever made in Roman London, which was a temple to Mithras, friend of the show, who featured in the World Cup of Gods.
But before that, Tom, do not throw away this story about Boudicca and the skulls. So the story goes that she and her, now remind me, I'm trying to remember my 9-year-old history lessons. She and her daughters have been molested by Romans and in revenge.
So she's the queen of a tribe called the Iceni, who inhabit East Anglia, Norfolk, that kind of area. And her husband, Prasutagus, is an ally of the Roman people. When he dies, the Romans move in and they rape Boudicca, they rape her daughters, and... this is an unwise thing to do, because Boudicca raises the Iconians, and they sweep down and they burn Colchester, they burn London, they burn Verulamium, St. Albans. And it looks as though the entire future of the province is hanging in the balance. And they meet with Suetonius Paulinus, who is he's been attacking the Druids up in Anglesey, and he comes haring back when the news reaches him and meets with with Boudicca's army and wipes them out.
And the skulls, the young men.
Yeah,
these are what, Roman soldiers who've been caught basically in London.
Presumably they are civilians. The Britons are headhunters. They're kind of trophies,
right?
That presumably. I mean, we don't know. I mean,
it's very hard to darness.
Very hard to dance. Yeah. Well, it's. I mean, the thing about Roman London, our understanding of it is based on a kind of meshing together of documentary sources, which are often very fragmentary. So we do have Tacitus say on Boudicca, but then there are whole periods where the city is simply not mentioned at all by Roman historians. So you have to fill in the gaps with archaeology.
Because it's inconsequential to them, basically, because it's in Britain and it's a long way away and who cares?
Yeah, basically.
And the people who lived here, I mean, okay, there's very little evidence one way or the other, but your best guess, Tom, the people who lived here, they're kind of Romano-British. Are they Celtic extraction? Are they of Celtic origin?
Well, I think it's likelier to be. Certainly there would be people who are British living here, but it would also be lots of people from abroad. It would be settlers and traders and so on.
Yeah. So lots of. Proto-French coming over.
Well, it's interesting. There's so probably the best preserved stretch of wall. And we'll come to the walls later on. Is by Tower Hill. There, as part embedded in part of the fabric of the medieval wall when it got built, was a tombstone of a Gaul who'd come over here in the wake of Boudicca's rebellion to kind of basically set up a tax apparatus that would not provoke rebellion. So to try and kind of calm things down. So he's the colonial administrator who comes in, but he's a Gaul.
Right. That's interesting.
So you can see how, of course, I mean, Roman London is connected to Gaul closer than it is to Rome. So there are probably people from Italy here, but they're more likely to be traders from Gaul.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have now arrived outside the London Mithraeum. And this was found in the 50s. So, you know, the Blitz was tremendously good for Roman archaeology. And it was found, it was again, kind of by the site of the wall, by the banks of the Walbrook. And it was very, very inconvenient for the developers. You know, they didn't want a temple to Mithras. Yeah. And the reason that it's preserved is because, you know, as listeners to the World Cup of Gods will remember, that basically Mithras worshippers are kind of like masons, male only. It's all about kind of signing up and making friends and contacts and that kind of thing.
It's like Brooks is for you, Tom.
Well, perhaps a little bit. But the temples are situated underground. This temple had survived for that reason. It was kind of very deep in the archaeological layer, but inconvenient for the developers. So they removed it and they situated it next to a very busy road and surrounded it by 1950s style crazy paving. So it could not have looked less romantic. But then when Bloomberg came here and developed this space, and part of the planning condition was that they had to provide a new space for the Mithras temple, which they've done, I have to say, absolutely superbly. So you can go in here, anyone in London can visit it. It's a really, really excellent experience. You go deep, deep down. They've kind of set up sound and light shows so that you have a sense of what the temple actually looked
Sounds
like.
Sounds great, Tom. Let's
it
go
is
in.
Very good.
Let's go in.
But we're not going to do that. What we are going to go in is go and have a look at some of the organic material from the Walbrook, which is preserved inside.
So, Tom, we've come inside. And just for people who don't know the area, it's right next to Bank Tube Station. We're in the heart of the city, surrounded by massive towering office blocks. And here is this fantastic looking little museum. And Tom, for people who don't know, a Mithraeum and Mithras. So this is this very obscure god, isn't it? The heyday of the empire, basically a sort of club for the officer class. Is that fair? That men, sort of upwardly mobile, aspirational Roman men, sort of captains and so on, they gather what, underground? And we don't know what they do. Do they? Something to do with bulls.
Yeah. Well, Mithras is meant to have killed the bull at the beginning of time. And the cult of Mithras kind of replicates this.
Yeah.
So this temple is built around AD 240. And it's as you say, a cult. I mean, you know, we said very like the Masons.
Yes.
It's the kind of place where you go and you meet useful people. And it has kind of different grades. So you go in at the bottom and the ambition is to go higher and higher and higher.
Excellent.
At the start of the show, I mentioned the very earliest document ever found written in Britain,
yes,
which is this IOU from the very early years of London. And this is it. So you can see it there. Very exciting. But next to it, there is another one. And this is, in a way, equally exciting. So probably from 65 to 70. So, you know, less than a decade after the incineration of the city by
Boudicca. Almost 2,000 years old.
And the reason that this is exciting is this is the first ever mention on a document from London of the name of London. So Londinium.
So what am I looking at, Tom? Because, I mean, it's very, very faded. Yeah, it's a wooden tablet, and they've scratched on it with a stylus.
Yeah, and so there'd be wax on it, and the imprint of the stylus would leave marks on the wood.
Yeah.
And then it gets chucked out, gets thrown into the mud, sinks into the mud of the Walbrook, and it's then preserved. And so whenever there's excavations here, you know, we're in the heart of the city, so they're always building, digging deep foundations. This stuff gets turned up, and you can see there's all kinds of, you know, so there's coins, there's amphorae, there are keys, there's nick combs, yes. There's all kinds, you know, mosaics, so all kinds of stuff.
It's a fantastic hoard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful. But I think the stuff that is really moving and powerful is the organic material, which otherwise doesn't survive. So as well as this writing stuff, you've got an oar, you've got a piece of a door, and you've got a sandal.
Yeah, the sandals kind are great, of wonderful. Aren't they? The sandals are beautifully preserved.
Really, really wonderful. Anyone in London who hasn't been here, it's an amazing thing. It's free. We're not going to go down into the bowels of the building to look at the Mithras temple.
Well, we haven't been initiated, so
we can't. No, we haven't. Although we are men, so we are allowed to do it.
Right.
But part of the problem is that we don't have huge amounts of written material explaining what's happening in the history of London. So we have to kind of work out from the archaeology. And most of the buildings of Roman London in its heyday have vanished. So all you really have are fragments. And I think part of the fascination of Roman London is the way in which you can have a sense of it as it actually was, but it's also a place of myth and fantasy. So rather like, you know, Conrad imagining the Roman centurion coming up the Thames estuary, over the entire sweep of its history, so all the way through the Middle Ages, through the Tudor period and so on, these fragments of Roman London that have been found by later periods have generated myths, fantasies. So I think we'll go for a break now. And when we come back, we'll go and have a look at a few of the fragments that are preserved. And they appear in quite odd contexts and interesting contexts.
I look forward to it.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest Is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are in the heart of Roman London. We're by some roadworks. There are lorries. It's incredibly glamorous. And Tom Holland, who's been talking about doing this podcast for basically as long as I've known him.
I'm so excited.
Has stopped by one of his favorite artifacts, which is basically just a big stone. So, Tom, tell us about this stone.
Anyone with any interest in Roman London knows the thrill to be had from looking at lumps of stone. It's what it's all about. So we're opposite Cannon Street Railway Station, and we're looking at what is called the London Stone.
Right, it's
which
good
is
name.
One
Catchy
of
name.
One of the weirdest, most kind of folkloric things to be seen in the whole of the capital, and it's first mentioned, I think, in the 12th century, and it was this great, this huge kind of stone that stood in the middle of Cannon Street, and it was believed that whoever you could ride up, you could touch it with your sword, and then you'd rule London.
Well, I have a good fact about this, Tom.
Yeah?
Did you know that in 1450, the rebel leader Jack Cade, leading a rebellion against non-friend of the show, Henry VI, he struck it with his sword and claimed to be Lord of London.
I did know that, because it says that on the placard, which is right next to it.
Tom, don't spoil the illusion.
Exactly so. And did you... Oh, an ambulance is going past.
It's the history police, I think.
Dominic, did you also know that in 1742, the London Stone was moved to the north side of the street and eventually set in an alcove in the wall of St. Swithin's Church on this side?
Yeah, you're very blatantly reading the placard.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. Okay,
so this is this kind of... It's a sort of folkloric... How weird that this one stone, which frankly, I've said a big stone, but it's... I mean, it's not that big.
So over
it's
the
size, size of a very large parcel, basically.
So originally, it was much larger.
Okay.
And people have been chipping bits off it over
claiming
the course
to be
of the
Lords
Middle
of
Ages.
London and...
all that kind of malarkey. And basically, nobody has any idea what it was or where it came from. So John Stowe, the great Elizabethan antiquary.
Yeah.
He says, the cause why this stone was set there, the time when, or other memory hereof, is none. And so over the course of the centuries, people have come up with all kinds of theories as to what the London Stone was. So very popular theory in the Tudor period was it had been set up by Brutus, the Trojan who came here and killed all the dragons, the founder of Britain. More recently, people have thought that it was a great stone on which the Druids conducted sacrifices. Other people have said that it's the Palladium, so it's the kind of a stone that symbolizes the city, and that if it gets stolen, then the city will fall. So
a
it's
bit
a
of the
kind
ravens
of,
in the town.
Yeah,
of
it's a kind of lapidary equivalent of the ravens. And even now, there you know people are into ley lines and that kind of stuff. Peter Aykroyd and everything, you know, all kind of obsessed with the London.
I'm surprised I can't see Will Self here or
yes,
someone like that.
Exactly, but the where we're standing now is where the Praetorium, so the governor's headquarters would have been, of which there is no trace whatsoever.
No, it's just a Leon.
And the theory is that this marked the gateway into the governor's headquarters.
And so some sort of memory of that was preserved.
Yeah, and so it was preserved. So the Romans leave. There is this kind of great archway here, and it's preserved, and it kind of sinks into the accumulated dirt of the Saxon town. And it's kept as a kind of totem of the city. So if that's the case, then this is the only fragment of the Praetorium that we have. But we don't know. And that is both the kind of the fascination and the frustration.
I think the mayor of London should come and be sworn in touching this stone. Don't you?
So essentially, unlike, some of the grander Roman cities...
Yeah.
So little remains of Roman London.
And we're jumping ahead a bit, I know, in time. But the reason for that is basically that the city falls into total ruin when the Romans leave in the Dark Ages, right? I mean,
Yes. So that, but it's also that the city plan as it exists now is essentially Anglo-Saxon. So it doesn't correspond to the Roman street plan at all. And the buildings are used, you know, they're cannibalized.
Yeah.
So the stone is used to build the new structures. And the thing that's distinctive about London is that you do have this kind of break, because when the Romans leave, the interior of London seems to have been regarded as cursed. You know, people don't move here. The Anglo-Saxon settlement is further down the Thames at Aldwych. And then you just have these kind of endless cycles of calamity that overwhelms London. So, yeah, you know, endless fires, endless rebuildings, and so on. And it's just kind of incinerated it. There are trace elements. They're almost all underground. So we went to the Mithraeum. That's kind of wonderful. There's also the amphitheatre, which is at the Guildhall, and again is a kind of underground museum, really worth visiting.
But how much of the amphitheatre is there?
You can see traces of it. There are
traces.
Kind of, yeah. Well, no.
That word traces. The producer's raising his eyebrows.
No.
Yeah, I followed your recommendations on holidays, and
I've learned
my lesson.
Okay. Well, let's say there is more of the amphitheatre than there is of the Praetorium.
For those people who haven't listened to our previous podcast, I should say, last summer my family went on holiday to Greece, and Tom recommended a temple in Sparta. He said it was absolutely brilliant. And my wife said, oh, well, we'll just check it on Google Maps first. So we checked it on Google Maps, had a look at the street view. There are about four very, very low stones in a field. And the first review said, popular haunt for the homeless and drug addicts. So we decided to give it a miss.
I think that speaks very poorly of your sense of adventure.
It does, yeah. I think but Dominic,
what I would say is that seen through the right lenses, if one is in the right mood, if one has a spirit of adventure, it's possible to accept that the very lack of remnants of a great building is in itself kind of romantic.
Terribly romantic.
And atmospheric.
So as I walk past this bronze of Costa, I feel stirred at the thought of the great buildings that were once on this spot.
So actually, what we're going to head to now is one of the most, I think, romantic spots in the whole of Roman London.
Oh.
And it's...
Don't oversell it, Tom.
It's a trace element of right. What was the...
That
one of,
that
if not
again.
The largest buildings north of the Alps, Roman buildings north of the Alps.
Okay.
And it was the Basilica of Londinium, which stood in the heart of the Forum. And we're now... So we're heading eastwards from Cannon Street. We've just come to London Bridge again.
So we're by Monument Tube Station.
So we're by Monument Tube Station.
By the great monument built to the Great Fire of London.
And we're going to head up to a place that we've already visited in the course of this series, which is Leadenhall Market.
Yes.
We went there for our goose in the Christmas Carol episode. And the Basilica stood on Leadenhall Market. And, you know, which is kind of fitting because the Basilica served as a market. It served as a kind of great assembly point. So people who've been into, you know, a basilica in Italy, kind of, you know, church.
Yeah.
Structure of churches was modelled on Roman basilicas. It was three stories high. So absolutely kind of sumptuous showcase building, illustrating for people that even in the kind of barbarous wilds of this chilly island set in the ocean, you could have civilised shopping.
Well, and as luck would have it, there's a Marks and Spencer's just up the road.
But it's almost completely vanished. But there is one chunk of it left, and I think we should go and have a look at it now.
So, Tom, of all the locations you brought me to, none has been more unexpected than this. This is it's a barber shop. There's no way of selling it otherwise.
Nicholson and Griffin Men's Grooming.
It looks excellent, actually.
So we're in Leadenhall Market now. This was always my favourite spot when I did tours of Roman London for the children of the primary school that my daughters went to. And I was that dad.
Who the other dads all hated.
I was that dad.
Who was always there,
no,
pestering
I wasn't always
the
there,
teachers
but I,
to let him do fun is, things with the kids.
This was the one thing I do every time we go on a tour of Roman London. And they, you know, 30 of them, little crocodile. And they'd come here and we'd stand outside the Nicholson and Griffin Men's Grooming. And they would let us go down into the basement. So you'd have a little crocodile of children would head down solemnly into the basement, see what is down in the basement, and then solemnly come back up. And we can now replicate that.
So that explains, Tom, why just by the, in the barbers, I can see a photo of you on the wall with a sign saying, do not open the door to this man.
Listeners, he is lying. Let's go in. Let's go in and see what's downstairs.
So we're fighting our way so
lots
past
of
the customers.
Chairs everywhere. And in the corner, what do we oh, see?
That there is it unexpected. Is.
So that's the basilica. So what we're seeing is we've got people having their hair cut.
Talking about the holidays.
Basins and stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of glass door, and beyond the door there is a chunk of recognizably Roman masonry. You can tell
it's
Roman,
yeah,
because very kind of thin, narrow bricks.
Yeah.
And that is all that remains of the largest building built by the Romans north of the Alps.
Tom, I take my hat off
to you. The Roman Basilica.
You've not oversold this at all. And it is more than a trace.
Yeah. It's
quite
great,
a good
it?
Bit of wall. And it's behind this sort of glass door. So it's clearly quite nicely preserved. You can come and have your haircut and then go and admire it. It's impressive.
It's absolutely the place to come for your haircut. It's a wonderful salon. And it provides you with a little bit of Roman archaeology as well.
Yeah.
What more could a gentleman
Even
want?
Even a producer who is the soul of cynicism is looking wide-eyed with excitement.
I think he's actually just had a haircut, which is a shame, because otherwise he could come down here and
have a kind of haircut and penance.
And the thing that's great is that there's a statue of Apollo, a bust of Apollo,
yes,
on the ledge next to it.
And there's a picture on the wall of
the basilica.
Of what,
yeah,
the thing, I mean, it looks, was it as big as this, Tom? That's huge.
Yeah, it was a really, really huge structure.
So, I mean, the size, what's that? The size of a football stadium, roughly?
Yeah, yes.
And so that was
And perfectly square. So the Roman Forum was perfectly square.
That picture is not the basilica, it's the Forum.
It's the Forum. Well, it's the basilica in the middle, and then you've got the Forum all around it.
Yeah.
And of course, that is a contrast with the modern city, because notoriously, the street plan in London, of the City of London, is an absolute mess.
Yes.
It's not a grid.
So this is beautifully laid out. Very.
So this is much more a kind of Manhattan style.
Yeah.
And the Anglo-Saxon street plan, which has replaced it, is, you know, that's why it's so difficult to get around the city. You always get lost. But back in the Roman period, much more of a grid pattern. And so you've got here, it tells you about it, this support or pier is the only surviving part of Roman London's basilica, served as the base of an arch in one of the basilica's arcades, housed Roman London's town hall, law courts, central market, built in AD 70. It was enlarged from AD 90 to 120, became the largest such building north of the Alps. So there you go.
Yeah, I'll take my hat off to you.
Okay, so I think there's one more of the great sites of Roman London to see, and that is the wall, which was built towards the end of the second century, possibly by a guy called Clodius Albinus. So
he's a usurper, is he?
Yes, Clodius the White, Clodius the Pale. So he took on Septimius Severus, who himself subsequently came to Britain. And actually died in York. And Clodius Albinus came to a grisly end. But it's very possible that he was the guy, because he was governor of Britain, that he built the wall so that London could serve as a kind of fitting capital for a would-be emperor.
But that would be ridiculous. I mean, to have London as your capital would have been ridiculous for a would-be Roman
emperor,
right?
Yeah, but he's starting off, so he wants to... I mean, a bit actually, you know, kind of like... Constantine as well, who is proclaimed emperor in York. Britain, there is this idea, you know, St. Jerome calls Britain the nursery of tyrants because it has three legions. And so therefore, it's a very, very useful place for a would-be usurper.
Yeah.
To have, you know, you can go conquer Gaul and then hopefully move on to Italy as Constantine does. And so the walls have to, you know, I don't think that Roman London was under any military threat at the end of the second century. But the walls were built to serve as a symbol.
Yeah.
A grand, prestigious capital.
Sort of status, prestige.
Status, yeah. Had to have walls. And these walls provided essentially, I mean, that they you know, they lasted up until quite recently. So the gates, you know, so you have Ludgate, you have Newgate, you have Bishopsgate, Aldgate. All these gates preserve the trace elements of the wall that existed. They're a very, very sizable chunk, as I think I mentioned, by Tower Hill.
Yeah.
And there are other traces as well. And I want to take you, Dominic, to see what I think is the most romantic the most unexpected chunk of the wall. And again, it will require us to go underground.
Excellent. I look forward to it. So, Tom, we've been walking along the line of the Roman wall. Very exciting, but a moment of excitement and extraordinary drama that we couldn't possibly have anticipated. We stopped at some traffic lights, and who should be there? But would you want to tell the story?
A wang.
One of our wangs, James,
who I think works at the Guildhall.
Stopped us and said the sentence that I think both of us have been waiting all our lives to hear. I'm one of your wangs.
So James, if you hear this, it was great to meet you, I hope you're enjoying this show.
And just to explain, the producer said just before we cancelled on the grounds of just saying demented,
mad stuff.
The Wangs are members of the Restless History Club, which you can of course join at restlesshistorypod.com.
James at a very, very reasonable price.
Yeah, James will tell you it is. Practically, yeah, peanuts, get all kinds of treats and delights.
Yeah, we're giving them away.
Now, back to the Roman wall. We walked along the course of the wall, and here we are. And it is actually a genuine bit of wall, Tom.
It is genuinely a stretch.
It's more than a trace.
Although, we're now on the Barbican. And the Barbican takes its name from a Latin word, a late Latin word, Barbicana, which is a watchtower.
Okay.
It was built towards the end of the Roman period. But the stretch of wall that we're looking at now is not actually built by the Romans.
Oh.
So we're looking at crenellations, and this was built by a friend of the show, Edward IV.
Oh, my word, Tom. This is incredibly disappointing.
But the medieval wall, of course, is built on the line of the Roman wall.
Right.
So the Roman wall
The bricks are wrong, aren't they? They're not the same kind of bricks that the Romans were.
So, again and again, the Roman city lies underground because there's been this kind of accumulation. The reason I brought you here is we're just east of Cripplegate. So why is it called Cripplegate? Well, according to Stowe, our antiquarian friend from the Elizabethan period, it derives from the cripples begging there.
Oh, right.
That's what he says. Okay. I mean, that seems the most improbable explanation.
Really?
I think so. I think people have no idea why it has that name. But Cripplegate, we're now on the site of the Roman fort. So the Roman fort was built before the walls were built, around 100 AD, 120. And the walls kind of, the line of the wall was joined up with the fort. And so that, you know, this garrison protecting the city, protecting the governor, this kind of crucial center of the Roman province. But I want to take you to see one particular stretch of authentic, ect Roman wall.
When you say authentic, I mean, is this authentic?
It is properly Roman.
Okay.
But to do that, unsurprisingly, we have to go underground.
Okay, you're always luring me into basements.
Okay, so Dominic, I've brought you further westwards. We're now...
We're outside the entrance into a multi-story car park.
It's not a multi-story car park, but it is an underground car park. We're by the Museum of London. There's another chunk of the medieval wall.
So this is Edward the Fourth's wall.
Actually, I think this is maybe even early modern. I think it's
Tudor.
Yeah, I think this is Tudor. Anyway, we're now at the London Wall
car park. Never let it be said that we don't go to the most exotic and glamorous locations.
So we're going into the car park, and we're directly under the line. So this, the street overhead us is called London Wall.
Yeah.
And all of this stretch got blitzed. The road that is called London Wall, which is basically runs along the line of the London Wall, didn't exist before the blitz. So this is all part of the city redevelopment that included the building of the Barbican.
Yeah. So the Barbican, for those people who don't know London, is this sort of colossal complex, it's a sort of monument, isn't it, to the 60s kind of spirit, isn't it? It's kind of semi-brutalist.
Yeah, famously you get lost. I've got lost
the Barbican many times.
Yes, it's a brutalist maze. So, but this car park was built as part of the redevelopment. And once again, you know, a familiar story on this episode, the developers found something unexpected, which was a chunk of the original Roman wall.
Tom, does it not occur to you that there must have been so much destroyed in the 19th century when they were digging the underground and so on? I mean, imagine the Roman artifacts that must have been lost.
Yeah. I think back then, if you were digging foundations and you discovered some Roman remains, you I mean, you'd probably keep it. You give a few chunks of it to an antiquarian and then you just get on with the business.
Yeah, you would.
I mean, it's an, interestingly, bearing in mind that Britain in the Roman period was a very peripheral province, a very kind of minor province, we probably know more about the archaeology of Britain than we do of any other comparable province.
Really?
Because the laws that have been brought in to conserve are so good and have been so good. And the tradition of antiquarianism in this country is so venerable that we actually know quite a lot about Roman Britain. And that's,
so Tom, I can't help feeling that we're just trudging endlessly through
we've been trudging through this car park, and there are bays, so we've got to 34 now.
Yeah.
And now we've got to 35, so this is probably the most thrilling
brilliant podcast.
Podcast has never been more exciting. And we just need to go a little bit further on, and Dominic, you will see something truly astonishing.
Okay.
But the problem is we've now only reached 38 and we still
what do we have to get to? 624.
What can we talk about to keep this going? Well, okay, I'll tell you about Hadrian.
Yeah.
So Hadrian famously comes to Britain and builds his wall. But it seems that just before he arrives, there seems to have been fires in London.
Yep.
And so he may well have sponsored much of the redevelopment. And it's unclear whether these fires were just kind of isolated accidents of the kind that happened all the time, or whether perhaps there'd been some uprising. We just don't know.
It's lost in history. This is probably the point at which I should tell the audience that I'm wearing new shoes that are unbelievably painful.
Whereas so I'm wearing walking boots.
So while Tom is whittering on about Hadrian, I'm just in mute agony as we continue to trudge through this underground car park.
I must say, we've now reached 48.
And what do we have to get to?
49, 50, 51, and at Bay 52, we are at Journey's End. And Dominic, I think you will agree that it's worth the trudge, it's worth the blisters, it's worth the slog along the very unromantic environs of an underground car park.
It's also fenced off,
to see
off,
what
which is
we have. So tell us what we have here.
It's just a bit of war, isn't it? I mean,
it is a bit of war. Disguising
it. So this is Roman. I mean, you can sort of tell by the again, you've got these very long, kind of flat, low bricks, haven't you? That very recognizable to anyone who's been
you're not sounding impressed. I think this is the most amazing thing to find in a car park. It's a chunk of Roman wall occupying two bays.
It's very moving.
And
yeah, you're right.
They've built,
the
car park around the wall. So
there's a few old scooters around.
Okay, I thought Dominic would be more, I thought you'd be more impressed.
I think the fact
they
fenced it off is a bit disappointing.
Yeah, but it kind of adds to the whole ambience.
Well, there's just a bloody big sign in front saying City of London, no parking.
Yes. Well, obviously you can't park there because there's a chunk of Roman wall there.
Yeah. And somebody's scribbled a bit of graffiti next to the wall that says, oddly, priority.
Okay, well, I think this is one of the great sights of not just the City of London, but
just to
but
be
the
absolutely
whole of London.
Clear, if you're flying to London from, let's say, America on holiday...
Yeah, go straight here.
I don't think this should be...
Yeah.
I don't think it should be in your top 10.
I think it should.
Well, above...
Well, the Tower of London and, Westminster Abbey, it's too obvious, but you want to see a chunk of Roman wall in a car park, this is where you come.
Yeah, your children will thank you for it.
Well, Dominic, you're a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
So the way that you get out of that... we go through a door over here and there is a very, very Doctor Who passageway. And what we're going to do now...
Oh, God, he's still going.
Well, I just want you to see the Doctor Who passageway. You might be more excited about that than the chunk of wall.
Okay.
Oh, it's actually quite dark. Maybe we shouldn't go along here.
You sure this is...
No, this is not sensible. This is not sensible. Normally... Oh, we'll just show Dominic how Doctor Who it is.
Oh, yeah, that is quite...
Yeah.
It is quite spooky, isn't
so
it?
I don't know if we can get out. Let's go and find out. Maybe not.
Tony, I wouldn't shut that door.
Oh, my God, and here's a Dalek. But I've got one more place, Dominic, to show you, and that is a kind of very moving sight, unexpected sight that takes us back to the end of Roman.
Is it in a car park?
No, it's not.
Let's do it.
So So Dominic, we've been seeing highlights of the great days of Raymond London, but for the end of the show, the end of our tour, I've brought you to the foot of the Gherkin, this kind of weird shaped tower in London.
And not just the foot of the Gherkin, Tom. We are literally right outside a building that says in gigantic silver letters, Holland House.
Yeah, well, where else? Absolutely my favourite place in London, and properly where I should be living. And I hope one day to move in, take it over. But Dominic, the reason I've brought you here, you are actually now standing. You're standing on a grave.
Oh, my word.
So buried here. So what we've got at the in front of the Gherkin, there is a black paving slab with a kind of laurel wreath
on
it.
Yeah, with a wreath on it.
And then next to it, there is some marble engraved, and you've got in Latin, Dies manibus puella incognita Londiniensis hic sepulta est. Translation: to the spirits of the dead, the unknown young girl from Roman London lies buried here.
So what's the story, Tom?
So when they were digging, and again, it's, you know, again and again, it's about developers digging stuff up and to their fury, discovering traces of the Roman city. And what they found here was something really, really amazing, which was the grave of a young girl. And that's odd because the Romans did not bury people within the city limits.
Yeah, they buried them outside
so
the city.
So there's a clue there that probably she is Christian, because those kind of earlier taboos prevailed much less with Christians.
Right.
And sure enough, when they dated the bones, they found that they dated her to 350, 400.
So it's plausible she could have been a Christian.
Yeah, and so it's towards the end of Roman Britain, and the city of London by this point was in decline. We are within the limits of the city walls, but perhaps by this point, you know, already the population is falling.
Yeah.
Buildings are kind of being given up to market gardens.
So what
so
we
on.
Can imagine is sort of this is an area of what? Allotments,
yes,
overgrown.
Exactly.
Maybe
exactly.
Already becoming ruined.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of so the focus of activity in the very, very kind of last decades of Roman London would have been down towards the port, down towards the docks. And we are further up from that. So you can imagine that this would perhaps be kind of agricultural land by the end of the fourth century. But the story, her story is, I think, I mean, it's very touching, and it's a perfect end for this tour, because again and again, we've also been saying another theme is how people kind of project fantasies onto these strange trace elements that they find. So what happened with this was that her remains were put into storage in the Museum of London for about 3 years. And then 2007, once the Gherkin had been completed, they held a religious ceremony for her. So there was a memorial service.
Of what religion?
Well, there was a memorial service held for her at St. Botolph's Church, which is around the corner at Aldgate. And there was a full-blown procession from the church that came here. So there were vicars and all kinds of people.
Yeah.
But there was also the Lady Mayoress. And they came here and laid her on this, beneath this slab that we're standing next to now. And the Lady Mayoress scattered rose petals.
Is that what the Lady Mayoress thought Romans would have done?
I think so. Well, you have to kind of create traditions, don't you?
So basically inventing a Roman.
You have to invent traditions.
Russell Crowe came and scattered some soil on
something.
And
the wonderful thing was, is that so ever since the mid-19th century, there's been a ban on burying people within the limits of the city. But they put in a special provision that in 2007 that you could bury people here, you could reuse burial plots if the previous occupant on the site had been there for more than 75 years.
And
so obviously with her you could, because she'd been here for kind of 1600 years. So that kind of intersection of developers and archaeology, of, you know, material finds and fantasy.
It's the story of this episode, isn't it?
It's the story of this episode.
It's a nicely kind of melancholy, haunting note on which to end.
Yes, and it reminds us that essentially Roman London fades away and ebbs away, and we don't really know what happens.
Well, we will be taking up the story of London in future podcasts, won't we?
I'm
sure by the time we're finished, we'll have been through every period of the capital's history. But I think for now, we would say, what do we say? Valet? Valet?
Ave atque vale.
There you
Hail
go.
Hail and
you
farewell.
You heard it from the horse's mouth. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest Is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening,
and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.